Welcome to Art Ladders, The Creative Climb with Valerie Allen and Armin Merzman. This podcast is focused on interviews, features, and stories about art. It's for artists and art lovers. I'm Val. I'm the abstract artist in the group, joined by Armin, the realist. Welcome to episode 60 of Art Ladders, The Creative Climb. Today is one of our coffee chats together. We always look forward to those. And I'm a Instagram surfer, as everyone knows. And I recently saw a post on Saab Gallery Collection. And if you want to follow them, they are at sab.gallerycollection. And they had put up a post about Rick Rubens, a quote from him. And Rick Rubens wrote the book that was released earlier this year called The Creative Way, A Way of Being. And it's basically
a great book.
Yes. And
please buy it.
You've really referred to it in your classes, I know, Armin.
Yeah.
It's a series of inspirational quotes to motivate creatives. It's fairly easy read, right? You go from quote to quote.
Yeah, it's very kind of like a discussion, you know?
Yeah.
It's not preachy. It's has a lot of options that you might not think about. And Rick Rubin, you know, is a major producer for music. And I've always really liked that part of him.
Mm-hmm.
He's produced a lot of things from some of my favorite bands even. But his thought about creativity isn't linked to art making.
It is linked to art making.
It isn't just linked to
art
making.
Oh, it isn't. You're correct. Yeah. You are right on that.
How can you be a more creative human being?
Yes, that's interesting.
And you are a creative human being. Think of the things. Ask yourself, what problems did you solve yesterday that had nothing to do with art? It might have been you cooking something or something happened in the house that you needed to fix. You didn't know quite how. So you found a creative way to do that. That is the creative process.
Right. You know, the quote that caught my eye was during an interview with him on Instagram. So it was one of the reels. And he says, if you want to live in a creative way, which will benefit everything in your life, and it's what makes it great, is the personal in all its imperfections and all its quirkiness. That's what makes it great, how you see the world. And I agree 100%. A lot of times I know my family members have definitely called me quirky, and they'll say, we mean quirky in a good way.
I think a lot of people have called you that now.
I think a lot of people have called me that. But it's having the courage to bring that out in your artwork and to bring that out in your writing or in your music or in your day-to-day life. It's just letting yourself, your personal self, show your authentic self.
Right.
It's harder than it sounds. Would you agree with that?
At times it can be. Mm-hmm. And other times it comes easy. And there's just no way to bottle that up, you know, because the search for ideas as an artist comes from many different things. Mm-hmm. But I think trying to make it more personal and speaking more about yourself, how you see the world and what you want people to get from that. What do you want to convey in that little message of art, I think is important. And that can be all the way from, you know, social critical stuff, you know, back in like the German expressionists, or just the love of painting a flower.
Right.
And the beauty and the color and shape and how you appreciate that and how you appreciate that being in your work.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's all over the place.
I think this episode that we're having about making it personal is a really good follow-up for our last episode with John Seed. And, you know, he was talking about disruption in realism and even more disruption going on with his two new books and the way that he personally transformed himself from a visual artist into a writer. He found that more personal to him. That was his voice. And to make that leap, to say to yourself, I'm going to, you know, I've studied art and visual art. I've done this, I've done that. But I want to make a leap and really bare my soul in these writings. And so I think this is an excellent follow-up for us to tell how we feel we bear our souls to our collectors and our students and anyone who's around us. Hopefully it's coming across.
Yeah, and I think it is, you know. I don't know if there's ever been, well, I should say here and there has been a piece of art that I didn't feel personally connected to, especially when I was doing commission portrait
work. Right.
Some people thrive on that. For me, I was trying to make money, and so I started hurrying up, which got away from my style. I wasn't passionate about these people. And other people that were in that same group, Portrait Chicago, they loved that challenge. I was just not one of them.
You know, and commissions did come to my mind when we landed on this topic. We land on our topics probably about a week before we do the podcast. And there's so many ideas that we come up with that this is what we do. We love to talk about art. So this is not a problem to come up with a topic. But when this topic came up, my mind did leap to my background in the design world and also our use of commissions. How do we make those personal? And I started thinking about the design world. In the design world, you're given a problem by a client. They're telling you what they want. And then you have to translate it. So how do you make that personally connected to you? And at first I thought, well, that's not really possible because I'm fulfilling their dream. But it really is possible because they don't, a client may not know visually what they want. Let's say interior design, what they want their room to end up looking like. So that's where I come in when I was in that world, and I can put my personal stamp on it. And hopefully, because of my, let's say, empathy, I can land on exactly what they were thinking in their minds, but didn't know how to either say it or show it.
Sure.
And so in reality, the design practices become very, very personal. On the you know, the shoulders of the designer.
Right. Well, you know, going back to the portrait commission days, and just for you out there, if that's something you would want me to do, I'd have to, if it was on my terms, I would do that still, but it has to be on my terms.
Right, which I think is fair. Right.
And so when I did portraits for Portrait Chicago, it was, well, here's how much you're going to make. And you know, you wanted to do it in this as many hours. And the man, you know, he's a president of a bank and he's sitting there in a big chair like all a million other portraits are.
Right.
And I just didn't find a creative process in that. If I had more of me in it, and I'd say, well, why don't you sit on a bench instead and don't hold a pipe, but, you know, whatever, you know,
right?
Then I would be happy. But I got to tell you that I know plenty of great artists. My friend B.B. Winslow, who's an abstractionist, loves commission. He loves taking colors that he would have never thought about.
Right.
And using those colors, you know, and I'm just too stubborn. You want me to what? You do what? No, I don't think I will, you know.
I know. And I think that is fine, because really, when someone commissions you, your style is so unique that when they come to you, I'm guessing they want that quality in the work.
Sure.
So, you know, back in the day when you were a younger artist, still so handsome. No. And in the day,
yeah,
they didn't know you as well as an artist. So they were coming to you with an assignment and like a corporate setting, and they needed this ticked, and they needed the tie ticked, and they need the pipe in there.
Yeah, there was hundreds of them, you know.
Oh,
not all in the style that you know that I do, that very realistic style, but some of them were more sketchy and, you know, those kinds of things. And I always felt like it wasn't me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I felt like I'm a guy that's drawing, but I'm not a guy that's creating.
Right. Do you feel, though, and I'm going to be the devil's advocate here, do you feel that with a touch of thinking and maybe a little bit of meditation, you could have made it your own at that time period and worked with that idea?
You know, hindsight is a funny way. I mean, could I have maybe done it that way? I don't know.
Hindsight, yeah.
Certainly not who I am now. I couldn't all of a sudden start bending and doing, you know, fast sketches and stuff like that, because I'm so engrossed to my technique in both iPhonography and in drawing that it has to come from me. It has to be made by me. It has to be framed by me. Well, by you, because I've lost my framing skills. And
conveniently.
Yeah. And so it has to be my project from the beginning thoughts to the end thing. You know, so.
Okay, well, let's think about our audience, and let's think about our younger listeners out there who are on this path, and they do need the commissions, and they do need that income. If they had had guidance early on to have the courage to be more personal and the courage to voice to the client, this is what I do, and come across with confidence so that the client would say, yes, I love that language you're talking about.
Yeah.
Is that possible? I guess what I'm saying is, as a younger artist, do I wish I had had this pep talk of make it personal early on, and how that would have changed my path, if at all? Or do you have to go through life experiences to get to that level?
Well, I think so. You know, when I was a young artist, I'm talking about in my 20s or even before that, I mean, my first commission, and I was 14 years old, and I created a logo for the Texan restaurant.
Which I'm looking at right now, because I found an old photograph of that logo.
I'm so proud.
In fact, Avram Golden had taken a photo of it, and we have it hanging in our kitchen.
Well, I was 14 years old when I did that, and was proud. I put my name was almost as big as the logo was.
See, you were pretty confident 14 year old.
So, you know, even 20 years later, was hanging in the restaurants, and they say, "Oh, I saw this painting you did," because my name was so big on it. And I'm like, "When I was 14, I swear."
But yeah, that kind of kind of attitude, that kind of confident.
Well,
boisterous attitude.
My dad and I, or especially my dad, was always scheming. How can we make money off of this? You know,
yeah.
He didn't really say find your language. He did, but we're talking about this particular topic. Right,
sure,
now.
Sure.
So we were doing crazy murals and commission works, and he was doing commission works too, things he didn't like. And I saw him be very uncomfortable and rush through it. And a lot of times that spilled over into not selling the piece.
Right.
Because he didn't have soul in it. You know?
And the client
he
just
did in
couldn't
a lot
handle
of his artwork, but he was like me. I think he won. Making money was very important to him. And he had a support. Himself,
well, yeah, it's a necessity.
But
many folks.
Yeah.
You know, we've backed ourselves up with all of these, you know, teaching and different things that we do.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's taken a little bit of the pressure off of allows us to use our voice now in our own artwork.
Right.
And it's like the cherry on the cake. We've talked about that. But learning to make it more personal And when I refer to younger artists, each artist is different. Even the younger artists, some come out of the gate full on confidence and poise and can do this.
Right.
And boy, that's a beautiful thing to watch. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you, it's a great thing to watch.
You know, but with my teaching experience, your teaching experience, and my student experience watching the artists around me, I very rarely saw something that I would consider at this point in my life personal. You know, it was more technique driven. I want to paint like this person out there, or I want to paint like this person out there, or, you know, I want to paint like my teacher or whatever mm-hmm. it is, you know. And I think that's an important thing to go through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't see yourself at 13 saying, I want my own language, because even though there was a small thing that happened to me one time, I was about 11 years old and I did this drawing. And I might have mentioned this before in the podcast, but it's important for this segment here, is my dad came up to me and says, you are getting a style.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, and what's the style? I have no idea what you're talking about. Right.
Right.
But I remember that piece in my head, and it continues on from that piece when I was there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that particular part of my style wasn't there when somebody said, you have to do a portrait.
Right, right.
Now, in my own work of portraiture that I like, it's there.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So.
It's definitely a discovery, you know, as a young artist. I was definitely influenced by the artists I would look at, the artists I would see in museums. And I guess Picasso was more influential on me than I realized.
Right.
Yeah. And someone asked me just the other day, in fact, yesterday on a live Instagram, why did you change, or how did you get to abstraction? You know, how did you get there? Well, then I realized I started in school being a realist. I was going through the fundamentals. I was rendering architectural mansions
mm-hmm.
and very realistic.
Did you do portraits?
I did some portraiture, yes. My realism, though, was more of a, I would say more of a heavy-handed realism.
Mm-hmm.
It was lots of darks and light contrasts.
Mm-hmm.
It had a little bit of a flavor akin to a woodblock print.
Right.
A little crude in mark making, very energetic.
So you are not concerned with the idea of making it look more like a photograph or something?
No, it took on a life mainly because a teacher told me once that whenever, for example, self-portraits. When you do a self-portrait, no matter how close you're drawing yourself or painting yourself, how close you are getting to being photographic, your personality will still come through in that self-portrait. And that's kind of haunted me, where your expressive nature is going to come across in that some way. So a self-portrait becomes more of a psychological study of yourself. Now, you've done self-portraits.
Till I got this age.
No.
You know,
you're getting ready to do a new one. But no, do you find self-portraits are very psychological?
Yeah. I mean, there is the obvious, you're aging kind of thing. But there's also finding proof of your journey within your face, you know.
Right.
That doesn't mean, you know, you have wrinkles. And of course, you know, at some point you get wrinkles. But I mean, you know, stress lines and all those kinds of things say
yes.
a lot.
Yes.
And if I were to do a self-portrait, I would put those lines in there and maybe even enhance those lines.
Uh-huh.
But when I was doing commission work, you know, the whole idea was make them look thinner and make them look younger.
Uh-huh. Sure.
You know, then they'll like it. And that was something that I hated to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know? That didn't fit your.
And I also wanted the audience to understand that photorealism, although I accept it and sometimes I like it, that was never a goal for me. You know, I wanted to be a realist, period. There's so many sub factors in you know, photorealism, magic realism, hyperrealism, and all this kind of stuff. And I'm not involved in those little subcategories. I just wanted to draw something that works with what I see. And how can I change it to fit into what I see?
So when you're working, and we'll back to the topic of, it's really great when you make it personal. How are some ways you make your work personal? Is it the subject matter? Is it while you're working on it? Is it secret little things you're hiding in it?
I told one of my classes a story about, I'm working on this tree, and I've been working on it since April, and I have to get it done by the end of the month for a show that I'm having. But we were having the same discussion, how did you get into trees, and what happened there, you know, this is it. And I go back to when I was about 12 years old, and it was snowing really hard, and I went out with my coat and sat in the wood and just felt the wood, you know what I'm saying? I felt like there was communication going underneath me between the trees and all this kind of stuff. I felt that I was part of the whole.
Yes.
Not just I'm a human in a wood. No, I'm part of this, right? And it was a very strong feeling. I remember it was very cold outside, but I felt completely warm, you know. And I sat there for must have been an hour, hours. And, you know, obviously I didn't die, but, you know, but that was so important for me that I started going to the wood a lot by myself. I felt much more in tune with things than being in a crowd of people or something like that. So how did that happen with the trees? And it was a mixture of drawing things that other people don't see or look at, and my respect for those trees. And so it's a combination of that language that has part abstract in it. You know, I tell a lot about that. There's a lot of abstraction in my work. I don't want people to be confused. I'm not an abstract artist. No, but I live with one. And she's great, but, you know, there's so many times I wish I was an abstract artist. And it doesn't mean I might not play with support some of it, but there was this abstraction in Winter Trees.
Right.
It reminded me of marks of Motherwell or something like that. And then I got obsessed with details, more so than other people were. I would look at this and travel through these reference photos in a real way. Why is there a shadow here? And I don't like this branch here. It works against the composition. I don't have to put it in there, but I might put an extra branch here. You know,
right?
I was not, or ever was I a slave to my reference photo. That's just the idea, the main composition maybe. And a lot of times I'll draw and I'll put the reference photo away for an hour or two.
Right.
I just go out on my own.
Yeah. I can just envision you out in the woods. You know, we have property down in Ohio, and the woods there are, well, since I was probably about that same age, 12 or 13, was a place I would run to as well. And the fields and the rolling hills, and those influences stay with me too, in the form of mark making and tangled marks like you're describing that you use. So we have a lot in common that way. But in the winter time, the trees, you've often said to me, winter is one of your favorite seasons.
If it wasn't so damn cold.
I don't know if that's still holding true as we get a little older, but the way the trees are skeletons at that point, and you see all the branches, and it's so beautiful.
They become 1,000 marks. You know, and they describe things, how they bend.
And if you crop into that, it's like a Jackson Pollock mm-hmm. comes alive. I mean, it's just amazing. Yeah. So nature, definitely very personal to me, very personal to you. Nature in my work can come across as a color, atmospheric color, where I'm building layers on top of layer,
mm-hmm.
Or the smells that you would get in an evening walk when the mist is coming up out of the valleys. Just amazing. So that is when you dig deep into yourself looking for subject matter, those are the types of things you can find when you think back to your childhood, mm-hmm. and specifically to those years of about the fourth grade up to the eighth grade. You get totally, I don't want to use the word jaded, but not as receptive to incoming.
Well, we started, at some point, you start worrying about what other people.
Yes, you know? Yes.
And when I was a young artist, I could care less. And let's not be that blame. I did get comments on it. People liked it, which spurred me ahead. But I never drew things like my fellow students. A lot of fellow students do cars.
And, right. You start the popular subject matter.
Whatever that stuff is.
Yeah. And
I'm like, no.
Right. You didn't get to go
no
there.
I had no interest in it. But I wasn't drawing trees either, but, you know, I was trying to, with my dad's help, draw what I see.
Mm-hmm.
He had me look at something, not a photo of something, but he had me look at something, and he made me explain to him, what do I see?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so mm-hmm. what, I see a glass. Well, how do you know it's a glass? Well, it's transparent,
mm-hmm.
right? How do you know it's transparent? There's a fork in it, and all of a sudden it gets wavy.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so from the beginning, I started taking things apart with my dad's, how can I say that? Insisting that I look at things.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't always happy. I mean, I drew cartoons for a while and he flipped his lid.
Uh huh. Yeah. So as we're digging deep into personal language, think about day-to-day experiences that can happen that relate back to your language. And I'm doing the same thing as I'm asking you that. I'm racking my brain here. Day-to-day experiences.
Are your art eyes always there?
I feel like my art eyes are on, really on, when I am alone and I'm traveling in a car, and I do that a lot.
Right.
I relish road trips.
Oh, you do.
I know. Yeah. I relish riding.
I've only seen you two or three times this month.
Yeah. I love being in a car. Preferably, this kind of sound might be a surprise to folks, but by myself.
Yeah.
Because I turn my art eyes are on big time. And I don't know how many times I'll get reference, even from the back of a semi truck. Total reference.
Yeah. I know you mentioned it in the past, and you say, oh, you know, you come back and I have an idea because I saw this and I saw this.
Uh-huh.
And how can I deal with that and make it personal? You know,
right.
Is what we're talking about here.
It feeds me.
Yeah.
Of all the experiences I have, probably the second would be taking a walk. Mm-hmm. Again, alone. You have to have time alone.
But I've always noticed, you know, I teach a class called iPhonography.
Right.
Which is about app stacking and not using apps, but either using a lot of apps and using transparency and build your photo from the ground up.
Mm-hmm.
Build what you want the world to look like. Right. And so we work on themes.
Right.
We work on themes.
Yeah.
And that automatically puts on my art eyes.
Yeah.
Because I have a theme. So I look, what does that theme mean to me?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it is something that's a little more direct and more focused than just going out and putting my art eyes on.
Uh-huh.
The reason I say that is because I don't know artists don't always have those on. You know,
No, you get busy.
Yeah, no, no.
I get, when I'm around a lot of people, it's very hard for me to focus on imagery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, art is with me 24 hours a day in some way, but not necessarily in the creative way. You know, when I look at other people's art, and I've always found myself not to get too inspired by that.
By other artists.
Yeah. I fought against it. Do I have artists that inspired me? Of course I do. But I never thought, you know, I think I'm going to do things like this. Because the person really took it to a point where I couldn't be better than they did. So, you know, there's thousands of artists that I look at and enjoy, but I enjoy those like a person that goes to a museum that's not even an artist.
Right, right.
You know,
I do like to read about, I'm going to call them my heroes. I do like to read their journey through life to see what similarities that lifestyle may have to my lifestyle.
Right.
Now, that to me is more fulfilling than trying to copy one of their paintings. I want to know their life. You know, where did they go? When did they know they were going to be an artist? You know, where did they study? Who did they meet? Who influenced them? I love picking apart that sort of information because I find when I'm in the trenches then, when I'm in the studio and I'm working, I can reflect back on, oh, you know, Robert Rauschenberg out there on the island of Captiva and the hurricanes coming in. I can build these crazy stories of artists making art in all these different surroundings. And it's very inspiring.
Right.
Extremely inspiring.
Yeah.
And just that idea of not copying, but knowing their life.
Yeah, matter of fact, when I see a piece of art that kind of blows me away, I stay way away from that. And it might be art that you wouldn't think I would like. Not you, but people that know me, I would like. I'm, you know, and I like it all. And I even understand and find interest in conceptual art, like the banana that was taped to the wall, right? Made such a big deal. But I thought that question, what is art? And then it needs to be questioned all the time. So it certainly was talked about, mostly not in a good way. But, you know, for me, art, and I already said that, it's personal because the idea can come from anything. It could be from a song. It could be from a book, a poem.
Right.
It could be I'm sitting there and I see a certain tree. Pirouette, the drawing I did last year. I'm actually at the dentist's office and I couldn't stop looking at this tree. And I was trying to get the dental assistant, do you see that tree? And she's like, yeah, all the time. Don't you think it's beautiful? It's a tree. Okay, there we go. That divides people who look for interesting things or people who just take interesting things for granted.
Well, you know, you've got to give a little bit of grace because people in their workplace and you're probably sitting there with, I don't know, Novocaine or whatever. And you're like, oh my God, did you see that tree? And
no, I'd get to say a teeth cleaning. I don't know any Novocaine here.
Okay.
But it's like,
she's like, okay, but
just the tree, you know. I suppose you feel that way if you have you live next to the ocean, right?
Oh yeah.
And people come in there and they're blown away. And
right.
Well, you had a condominium that faced Lake Michigan.
Yeah, well, Lake Huron.
Oh yeah. Lake Huron. And did you ever take that for granted?
I hope I didn't, because I did love sitting out on that deck listening to the waves, especially at twilight. So I hope I didn't, but I'm sure I did.
Yeah.
I'm sure I was in there doing my day-to-day, you know, loading the dishwasher and going, oh, well, yeah.
And then you have a visitor and they say, my God,
yeah, look at this.
Look at the view.
Because it did envelop you. It really did.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's crazy. So Rick mentioned in his quote as it went further on in that reel, having antennae that would reach out and grab these ideas? Do you feel like we're talking about your art eyes? That's probably our antenna going up.
Mm-hmm.
And is it a conscious? I mean, do you go, okay, right now I'm going to have my art antenna up? Is it that deliberate, or does it seep in naturally?
I think it's a little bit of both. I am not a big fan of being in a car and driving, which makes it perfect.
Mm-hmm.
You like to drive. I mm-hmm. don't. And so when you drive and we go, I get to look a lot around.
Right.
More so than you can, right, because you're driving. I've been doing a series called Window Surfing, where I take photos. I put the camera next out of the window, or the phone.
Uh-huh.
And I don't look what's going to happen. If I see something, I snap it. It uh-huh. doesn't matter what it is.
Uh-huh.
And that is a very interesting thing, because it's very unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
So I like doing that.
I love that idea. Window surfing.
Mm-hmm.
That could be a thing. I think I'm going to turn that into a hashtag, because that is cool.
Well, yeah. I mean, you only see what you see at the time.
Right.
I don't look around on what's coming up. Oh, good, there's a tree coming up. I make this decision instantly when I see a good composition.
Uh-huh.
It isn't a barn, or it isn't a statue, or it isn't something that's normally beautiful. But I'm so in tune to composition,
right,
that I can make a direct image of it. Do they work out? Once in a great while.
Right. But the more you make, the more they'll turn out.
But it's better than sitting there and, playing a game on my computer.
Absolutely. It's good.
Not
use
against
of
you
time.
Guys that play games on your computer.
No, right now, but right? It's a good use, especially when I'm driving and you're the passenger.
Mm-hmm.
And now that I know you're window surfing, oh, I like that idea. Mm-hmm. I like it a lot.
Yeah. So the antenna or the art eye, a lot of times if I'm driving,
mm-hmm.
I'll look at things and ask myself, I wonder how they painted that. I'm already taking nature and breaking it down into a technique.
Right.
I know it's not painted, but I ask myself, how did they make that mark? Or how would I make that mark?
Mm-hmm.
But I think about that in the third person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Hmm. Do you ever have coincidences that come up that then lead to an art idea?
Give me a for instance.
I put this in my notes and coincidences, and I really didn't have a, it's kind of like one of those thoughts that I thought, well, maybe coincidences, maybe chance meetings with people. Now, when I think about chance meetings with people, I think that can lead to a new inspiration, mm-hmm. definitely. I'm trying to come up with a, for example, a specific. Let me see. I'm going to look into you for some help here.
Okay. That doesn't happen to me too much.
Uh-huh.
Coincidences.
It's probably in my travels. And all of a sudden I find myself at the base of a hill, for example. Okay, I do have a specific right now. And it's a architectural dilapidated cottage.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, oh, that's kind of crazy. But I didn't take a photo. And so get back in the car, move on. And then a roadblock happens, which it did,
mm-hmm.
and forces me to turn back around and go back that house one more time. I still didn't take a photograph reference of it. Third, made another U-turn, hit another detour, taking me back. I was probably lost when you get right down to it. Back that house one more time. And you know what? I still didn't do it. And I still think about it to this day. What is that?
Well, an interesting thing, because when I'm driving somewhere and I have time,
right,
if I have to go to a destination, and if I see something, I'll drive by it and then I have to go back.
Yeah.
And that's as much due to my OCD as it is anything else, mm-hmm. because I'm driving. I just missed the opportunity of a lifetime, blah,
right.
blah, blah. And I go back, and maybe it wasn't as interesting as I thought. But I have to go back and get out of the car. You know, that's when I don't window surf. I actually get out of the car and start moving around and from different angles. And, you know, would this work as an iPhone piece? Would it work as a drawing? You know, but yeah, I do.
And see, I had so much trouble articulating what a coincidence experience would look like. And I just did. And I'm going to credit Rick Rubin for drawing my attention to make it more personal. He says, dig deep. I didn't dig deep enough. And here I am to this day regretting something that happened 21 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
So moving forward and doing this podcast with you, I have to realize, Val, sometimes you know, and to pull off a road, put on your flashers, get out of a car, for me, takes a bit of courage. You know, it's cars are flying by, and it's.
Well, this
I don't know.
Very infrequent on highway travel anyway.
Yeah, but
you're going fast. You don't want to get in an accident.
Right,
I have stopped.
Right.
Before,
so know. I just need to know. Just do it. Because here I am, and so that's making it personal, having the courage to make it personal, having the courage to get what you need. So, and that ties into my next thought, ideas that are passed over, ideas that you've had that you passed over, but then someone else jumped in and did it.
That happens. You know, I had that idea of, why didn't I do it? Because they're doing it so elegantly.
Yes.
And now I can't even do it because, you know, I'm copying somebody's song.
Right, right.
You know.
And that happens, doesn't it?
It happens all the time.
And I like to think of it this way, that I passed over that idea. All of those brain waves are out there floating around, and somebody else caught the wave, and they made it happen. So when we get these impulses, these ideas, we need to, number one, either follow through, or number two, be willing that someone else is probably going to catch it.
Yeah.
Maybe not.
And that's maybe okay. Not. I mean, you can't do everything.
Right.
You know, you have to pick and choose. And this is what I'm going to do. You know, when I get done with a tree piece, I always think to myself, I'm never going to do one of these again.
Uh-huh.
You know, but because I'm still drawn to it.
Right.
No pun intended there. But I'm drawn to it. I see it again. And I want to draw it again. I'm also interested in complexities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, complexities thrive me, especially when I see something I think I couldn't draw. You know, it's a personal challenge to me to do it. Have I given up on pieces? Here and there when I didn't get joy out of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. I'm not saying drawing necessarily, you know, 8 hours a day, 12 hours a day, whatever, is fun, but there's an enjoyment to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, woohoo, I'm drawing, you know.
Yeah. So changing, that ties in, changing projects midstream, or changing a painting or drawing midstream.
Yeah.
I do that.
You do that a lot.
Yeah. I do that. I can give it up. You know, let's say a 4-foot by 4-foot painting, totally do a complete underpainting story, building it up, and wake up the next morning and not paint over it with white gesso or anything
crazy
like that, but skim on a layer.
Right.
And I find excitement in that, because I think that's my personal story too.
It is your personal story.
I love the fact that yes, we go through challenges, but we have a new day. We have a fresh start. We can do another layer.
Right.
And so that becomes part of my personal story.
Well, what do you think of the old adage, don't let art become too personal?
Oh, I don't agree with that at all. I think it needs to be very personal. I think writing and visual arts, music, dance needs to be very personal. Now, when I say personal, I also tie in that personal aspect of your work, someone else out there is going to take it very personally as well, which in turn turns it into a more universal thought.
And what about the term, don't let art become too precious?
That I do agree with. Okay. And I prove it by layering over and over and over, giving it up and starting anew. Mm-hmm. That's what don't get too precious means to me. I don't mean, you know, taking a painting and putting it in a vault and making it archivally sound and all this stuff because it's precious as a finished piece. That's a whole different definition. Not making it too precious is stopping yourself, is putting a halt on it that I don't like.
Right. I've always had a problem with that term because
I know you have.
Because I understand it on some degree. What I understand it, where it works for me is don't be afraid to experiment.
Right.
You might think you have something perfect there, but then you put something else over it and you got what you never even thought you could get.
Right? That's pretty much my way of looking.
That's accidental process.
Yeah.
But every piece of art is a precious object to me.
Yeah, you know, that's where I think the definition gets mixed up. That's where I'm saying, you know, yes, of course, our language is precious to us. Mm-hmm. Yes, that layer is precious. Mm-hmm. And there's layers. And that's why I don't want to say the word hate, but I really have a problem with people critiquing my work midstream when they'll find a little spot. Oh, I hope you don't, because they know I'm going to layer over it. And I'm not looking at you, Arm. But when you see a spot, oh, I really like this little area right here. And I'll set my standard phrases, don't get too used to it, because you'll probably not see that tomorrow. That's my idea of precious.
Well, I've ran into people, the teachers and such, that they... You know, if you're in the early parts of the piece and you see something precious, get rid of it.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen that happen.
Well, it stops you.
It makes you cautious.
You protect it. Mm-hmm. You protect that little area that in the composition may not make any sense whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. And I also think there's a difference in isms, too. You know, abstraction and, you know, like a pencil drawing. If I'm working on a pencil drawing and I get a passage that I think is beautiful, I'm not going to get rid of that. I'm going to work with it. You know, I'm in the end, I might darken it or something like that. But usually when it hits, I keep it.
Yeah. Yeah. Your style and mine, the way we work is very different. Our thought process is similar, but the way we work is different. I'm usually working a canvas all over, and you're going pretty much segment by segment. Would you agree with that?
I wouldn't agree with it in those terms. I don't work like from a rough sketch into a finished product. When I start working, it's already 80% done as I go along. Mm-hmm. And I go along with what the shapes of the branches some in this the tree pieces. And then I move and go along with that, you know. But yeah, I mean, the way I teach art is, which is more the academic way, is get it in rough first and move out like that.
Uh-huh.
Because I know what I'm doing with my piece, and I can, they'll meet together. It's like building a bridge, the two sides at some time.
Right.
That's very important for the way I work too. But I work that way because I'm basically not that patient. And people think I'm really patient. You don't.
Let me tell you some stories.
No more stories.
Okay.
But I am not. And so in order to survive, I have to each day create a small piece of art that's nearly finished.
Yeah.
And the next day, another small piece of art that's nearly finished. And then they connect in making a big piece of art.
Mm-hmm.
I found that's the way I had to deal with my thing, my artwork emotionally and intellectually. It worked for me. It's not a great way to start drawing, if you know. I don't know many people that do that.
Mm-hmm. I had something happen to me a couple of days ago where I was looking through old photos of my work, and I had taken, and I don't normally do this, I had taken step-by-step photos of a painting, and it was an abstract painting. And I have to tell you, and this will happen to everyone out there, art makers out there, I looked at the second photo and thought to myself, why the hell didn't I stop right there?
Did you ever try to go back?
I've been staring at that photo now for a couple of days, and I'm like, could I recreate that? Of course I can't. But you know what I can do, which I recommend to my students? I can make a list of everything I liked in that second photo, the second day of that painting. The energy, the diagonals, the contrast, the colors, everything I liked about it, and use that in a new painting. But isn't that funny that, it was a painting done probably 14 years ago, and I had about 12 different photos of the stages, and it was the second stage that just sang to me. You know, it felt really good.
That happens to me too,
Yeah.
especially in iconography, where you could save the image as you work on, but often I don't.
Right.
And then I start messing them up. I don't have anything to go back to,
Yep.
and I can never get back to it.
And I don't know if that is a good practice, to tell you the truth, because, it happened. That painting definitely had a different destiny than it did on phase two of my journey there. And but still, it really, really grabbed me this
I
time.
think that's a part of art making, you know. Sometimes I get done. There was a drawing I did in the last 10 years that I worked and worked and worked on. And once it was done, I didn't like it at all.
Oh,
And I put
yeah.
all those hours into it. I didn't know that when there was a square inch of work left. When it
Right.
was done,
You didn't get that
I didn't get,
thrill, that
no.
sit back in your chair and look at it and
Well, I'm never, I don't ever get that. Anyway, but
really.
no, I don't ever, once I'm done with it, I always go through 2, 3 days of depression,
Wow, that's interesting.
because it's not exactly what I wanted and never can be.
When do you get that satisfaction then?
Well, when I'm away from it for a while, I see
Okay.
it in a gallery or a show or something like that, and I look at it in a different kind of circumstances, I often say, wow, I nailed that. I really like that. But till it's out of my hands for a while, and I make sure that once I sign it, I don't mess with it anymore. Because you have to have a time when you need to quit. You know, if you're going to be a perfectionist, that means you've created perfect pieces. I have never created perfect pieces. You know, do I strive for projection, perfection? I don't even know if I suppose I do, but I know that that's not going to happen.
Do you ever look at your work after a bit? It's been out there a while, and you walk into a show, and the curator has installed the work. You haven't been there since it's been installed, and you walk in and you look, think to yourself, who did that? Who did that painting? Who did that drawing? Because you don't remember actually. I mean, you remember doing it, but you're like, how did that come out of me? That to me, that is a great feeling when that happens.
I don't like to be in competition with myself. I did something 7 years ago or something, or people come to me and say, oh, are you going to do another portrait like Gabriella?
Oh, that's
And
true.
I'm like, no.
That style thing, yeah, where
That
people,
was then, this is now.
this is now. This is now.
And
This is our life now. This is how we make it personal now.
I know we're getting on long here, but one question I have, what do you think about work that is social critical or political? Is that personal?
I think that when you make it personal, those issues come into it in your thought process, your day-to-day thought process, as more subtle than you think, but it's there. For example, my rural infrastructure series based on antiquated farm equipment, you know, architectural renderings, not renderings, they're abstracted historical buildings, that sort of thing. The undercurrent of how I grew up in Southern Ohio, in the farming community, and how that farming community has its extreme ups and downs, and very, very work ethic based, very, very hard living for people, and the way it's being manipulated through politics comes to me as I'm doing the work. If somebody looked at that work, I don't think it would be front and center in their minds that I'm making this big statement. That's how I use it.
Well, I think, you know, what's happening in our world today is going to be in your subconscious.
Yes.
But then you see people that are going to do a still life of something, and, you know, it's an orange ball and things like that. I don't know how that relates, but it appears more in my iconography. Matter of fact, I can hardly get away with it without not doing that in my iconography. Uh-huh. You know, all of those have some kind of a little dark edge to them. But in my drawing, that doesn't happen as much.
It doesn't happen as much, mm-hmm. The long-term work.
Because I'm going to spend, you know, 1,000 hours on this. I don't want to, you know, this is, I don't want to get depressed by my own drawing.
Right. And with the iconography, it's very immediate, and you're on a computer anyway. And so I'm sure things are flashing up on all your tech, your phone, and you're this and you're that. So it seeps into you.
Yeah.
And it's a way that you can quickly get that angst out of you. And hopefully, again, someone out there in the world will find a connection, and then it becomes universal, and then away you go.
Yeah. I mean, I don't sit down and say, I'm going to do a political statement about this, that, or the other thing. No, that's not the way it works. But as it grows, it starts telling me what it wants to be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I can just tell it to shut up.
No. tell your photo to just leave me alone.
Yeah. But
it's serious. It's serious. We're in a hard, rough time.
Yeah.
Rough time.
But I don't have problems with people that say, you know what? This is an escape for me.
Yeah. Art's the solitude.
I don't want all that stuff to come into my art. Mm-hmm. I respect it. And understand it too.
That's a whole, and that's a way you can look at it for sure. Mm-hmm. And by making it personal again, to get back to the topic, but you're making it personal because you're showing people that art can be an escape. Art can be a refuge. Mm-hmm. And that's how you're using it.
Right. Right.
And people are finding more and more the healing properties of creating art. Mm-hmm. So that's very, very worthwhile.
Right.
So yeah, this has been a very, very interesting topic. I encourage people to go out and read Rick Rubin book.
Get it on an audio or whatever.
Yes, an audio, The Creative Way, A Way of Being. It really, really makes you think. This is just one little, not little. This is one huge thought out of his thinking process,
right.
But there's so many more that will help artists mm-hmm. as well. So I want to give a great big thank you out there to our sponsors, Golden Apple Studio and Residency. Artist and director Shelley Stevens set out in 2009, wow, to create an environment for artists and writers to spend 2-week residencies to practice their creative process. That residency has now been going strong for 14 years. Armin, you and I have been there.
Yeah, and you've been there. You were there.
I've been there twice now. Yeah. Yeah. Talk about being able to get personal with your work over 2 weeks.
It's a beautiful place. Yes. And you can get as much peace as you want there.
Yes, it's nestled right along the rocky coast of Ripley Cove on the Atlantic Ocean. So you wake up to quiet and solitude. It's in down east Maine, and it's become a sanctuary in the summer for creatives. The immersion in nature, along with the meals, quaint cottages, and equipped studios, provide positive energy for all forms of art. So we encourage you to start a conversation and learn more via email with Shelley mm-hmm. at snstevens at goldenapplestudio.com or go to their website at goldenapplestudio.com. And you can also follow them on social media, Instagram and Facebook at Golden Apple Studio and Residency. Thank you again, Shelley. If you liked being with us here on episode 60, you may want to consider a mentorship with either Armin or myself. We are part of Masterius.com. That is an art network that connects mentors with artists. And Armin has a group that meets on the first Sunday of every month from 6 until 8. And my group meets the second Sunday of every month from 4 to 6. Those are both Eastern time. We host artists globally. And for those 2 hours, we are sharing our experiences in art and life with you. So if you feel that you're at that stage in your art career where a mentor may provide more focus and support for you, think about joining us. We would love to have you. Thank you again for listening. Thank you for listening. You can find our past and future episodes at anchor.fm, Spotify, and Apple Podcast. Be sure to follow us on our Facebook page, Art Ladders, The Creative Climb with Valerie Allen and Armin Mersman. Special thanks to our producer, Taylor Kramer of Cold Shower Media.
And check out our websites, valerieallenart.com, arminmersman.com. Stay creative, stay curious, and we'll see you next time.